This is a podcast from ABC Overnights.
In 1928 in Central Australia, tens upon tens of Aboriginal people were killed in what is now called the Coniston Massacre. It took place near the Coniston Cattle Station in the NT. Today, looking at that as part of our history segment, speaking to author Michael Bradley, who's written the book Coniston. Before we chat to Michael, here is some of the chats that happened last year when it was the 90th anniversary of the Coniston Massacre that were had between, you might have heard this on the Away program on ABC Radio, but it was the anniversary, and some of the people living in the area were spoken to, some descendants, some people living in the area today, about this very important event in Australian history.
My name's Harry Jagamata Nelson. The connection I have is that my uncle was involved in, I suppose you could call it murder, killing of a white person. They gave him a nickname, Bullfrog, but his Aboriginal name is Kamanyarpa. As his Aboriginal name is Jabananga. Kamanyarpa, Jabananga. Kamanyarpa is a name or word for some kind of snake, which we have very strong ties with that. And I certainly do, through him, through my uncle and my family as well.
When you read the literature about today, it says that the Coniston massacres were started when Bullfrog killed someone, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. Bullfrog killed that person for good reason. Yeah. That old fella, Fred Brooks, sort of hired or got friendly with the women, mainly Bullfrog's wives, and asked them to do a bit of home duty. He was living in a tent and, you know, kept those women working as maids, you know, washing dishes and washing clothes, that type of thing. That particular person, Fred Brooks, was trusted by the elders of the group who happened to be living here. Yeah, I just was told by my former elders before they passed away what had happened here 90 years ago.
What happened to Bullfrog?
He just bolted westward to his traditional homeland, and he wasn't charged, he wasn't arrested, he just led a normal life. He passed away when I went through my men's ceremony, initiation and other stuff. I sort of seen him and I buried him at Yundimu Cemetery.
Still live on, and how has it changed this part of the world?
Well, the people, there's no retaliation except by the police and of course the white people. Against the Aborigines, when that particular white person got murdered, hundreds of Aboriginal people were shot by this punitive party led by George Murray, Constable George Murray, and he sort of just went berserk.
The ABC's Oliver Gordon speaking to Harry Jacamara Nelson. You're on ABC Radio today for our Australian history segment looking at the Coniston Massacre, which happened in Central Australia in 1928. Michael Bradley is the author of the book Coniston. He joins you today. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining us today. This is a story that's very important in Australian history and something that you've written about. We heard a little bit there about some of the history behind the Coniston Massacre. Can you tell us the story and why this is something that Australians, every Australian, should know about?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think as you said, it started with a murder. So this was August 1928, right in the middle of Central Australia, of a couple of hundred miles northwest of Alice Springs, right out in the middle of nowhere in a station that was called Coniston. And there were very, very few white people around at the time in Central Australia. Had a very small white population, and was about 5 years into an extremely bad drought at the time. And Fred Brooks was a sort of itinerant station hand who's helping out on Coniston Station, which was owned by an old friend of his called Randall Stafford. And Fred had gone out dingo trapping. There was a federal bounty for dingoes back then. And he was out west of Coniston Station. He was probably the furthest west of any white man at that moment. And he was at a spring, a soak, as they called it, sort of a dried up creek bed, camping. And then early one morning, he was murdered, beaten to death by some local Aboriginal men. Circumstances of that are certainly unclear as to exactly why that happened.
Yeah, there had been stories that it had involved Bullfrog's wife.
Yeah, so
the man who was accused of the murder, Bullfrog, was his name that he was also known as, and that it was to do with his wife.
Yeah, there seems little doubt that Bullfrog was the leader of the killing, and most of the evidence indicates that Brooks had been using Bullfrog's wife either as a sort of domestic help or for sex, maybe as a result of a trade that had gone wrong, maybe taken her by force or kept her against Bullfrog's wishes. That's unclear, but whatever it was, Bullfrog was definitely unhappy about it, and Brooks had broken the rules of the law so far as the Walpree people were concerned, and they took the law into their own hands and attacked him and killed him quite brutally and left his body at his campsite, sort of half buried. His body was discovered quite quickly, sort of within the day. That triggered a police investigation that was led by the local police officer, Mounted Constable George Murray, under direction from his superiors in Alice Springs. Murray was based in Barrow Creek, which was the closest police post. He put together a sort of posse of local white men and a few Aboriginal trackers. And then there was a whole sequence of events, mainly at least two, possibly three, probably three separate expeditions that Murray led over the next couple of months. It's between August and October, that resulted in many, many deaths of Aboriginal people over a really wide area, supposedly as part of a manhunt for the killers, ironically none of whom were actually found, but really was just a long series of massacres.
And, you know, there's been different estimates as to how many people were murdered, some in, you know, around 20 or so, some are saying close to 100, some even 170.
Yeah, the official death toll was 31. That was what was reported by Murray himself and was accepted by a subsequent inquiry. So that's certainly the base minimum number of Aboriginal people who died. The real number, I believe, certainly well over 100. The best estimate I could come to was somewhere between 100 and 200, all things considered.
I did mention, and as we all know, this is important for everybody in Australia to know. I mean, the Coniston Massacre was the last recorded, documented massacre that happened in Australia. It's not the only one. There were many, many that happened right across this country. What brought you to this area of study, Michael?
I'm a lawyer by trade and a writer. I was doing some research in sort of related areas for some articles I was planning to write, and I was looking at the sort of the broader question of the intersection of Aboriginal people and the law through our history since white settlement, and came across just a mention of the Coniston story in sort of general reading, and it really struck me that it was very late in the day that it happened. More importantly, it struck me that I'd never heard of it, which I found surprising. So I started doing a bit of background research into it, and then I was even more surprised to realise that it had never been fully researched or written up, and it's such an urgent story and an important story, and it was obvious to me that it needed to be told, so it became a bit of a personal obsession to make that happen.
And there are films and docos that you can be seen, and lots of mob in oral history talking about it, but it's something that isn't regularly talked about or taught in schools, which is perhaps, you know, it is a big gap in our education system. And you come from a legal background. It's interesting that this massacre, it was organised, led by those who were meant to be carrying out law.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly nothing unusual about that. Plenty of other mass killing events that Aboriginal people have been led by or involved the law, and particularly police or military over the years. But yeah, this story had a lot of sort of aspects to it, I guess, that were interesting to me as a lawyer. One was the fact that it was ostensibly a legal response to the killing of Brooks. It also involved a couple of quite famous legal or criminal trials, because in the course of the hunting, Murray apprehended two random Aboriginal men, neither of whom had had anything to do with Brooks's killing, but he charged them with Brooks's murder, and they were actually tried in Darwin for his murder and quite sensationally and famously acquitted. And the record of that trial is pretty fascinating in itself. And then there was a legal process that sort of brought everything, was the sort of the final chapter of the story, which was a board of inquiry that the federal government ended up appointing under public pressure to investigate the Coniston massacres. And that was, and the records of that are quite comprehensive. But it was, well, it was a travesty of a legal process, and a whitewash of the massacres and the culpability for that. But yeah, from a sort of legal perspective, it was pretty interesting to look into that and dig quite deep into how that came about and what its process was. led to, and important because the report of that Board of Inquiry remains the official Australian government verdict on Coniston.
But before we look at the court case and the aftermath in that regard, when the actual massacres were occurring, of course it was women, children, men, nobody was left unharmed, unfortunately, lots of different people targeted. Did word spread to the rest of Australia?
Yeah, because it was, 1928, it wasn't so easy to keep the news quiet. And word got out actually really quickly. The news of Brooks's murder broke about a week after he died. The southern newspapers, particularly in Adelaide, started to pick up on what was happening in the desert with the killings pretty quickly. So they were starting to report it while it was still happening. And that led to quite an outcry, particularly from church and Aboriginal welfare groups started to make a fair bit of noise protesting about what was happening. So by September, early October, the federal government was starting to feel a bit of that heat coming onto them about what was going on and what they were doing about it, and that triggered a storm of correspondence back and forth between Canberra and Alice Springs while events were still unfolding.
And as events were unfolding, what was happening on the ground in the Coniston cattle station area?
Well, pretty much as soon as Murray and his team he started out with three or four white men and three Aboriginal trackers. Pretty much as soon as they started their work, word of that spread really quickly through the Aboriginal community, obviously, and they just dispersed. There was a widespread panic and rushing for the exits, basically, as the local Aboriginal people. There were basically two main groups that were directly impacted: the Walpiri people, whose land included most of Coniston, and the Caditch people, who were sort of to the north of the Walpiri, or their land was to the north. They sort of dispersed in all directions, and that whole area was sort of rapidly depopulating as people were trying to get out ahead of Murray. But he was obviously moving faster than they were, because his group were on horseback, and they caught quite a lot of groups of and some very large groups of Aboriginal people natting. Many of whom had no idea what this was about, and didn't know anything until they were ambushed, and in many, many cases just shot down. And wouldn't have had a clue why. And obviously there was a language barrier in any event, which would have prevented them finding out. So it was sort of wholesale carnage spreading across a really wide area, and because sort of retracing the steps of Murray's parties, and as I say, there were sort of three separate hunts. They were going all over the place, up and down the river valleys and out to the west towards the West Australian border. There was certainly no rhyme or logic to the path that he was taking. It appears that he was just sort of traversing back and forth across the same country multiple times, just looking for anyone he could find.
This was not an isolated incident in the sense that massacres were happening across the country.
Yeah, well, at that time, certainly the sort of the volume and frequency of massacres had
decreased.
But
prior to when it was settled, that was, you know, all over.
Yeah, so yeah, there was, this was sort of the repeat of a pattern that had occurred throughout Australia in every part of the country as it was in the process of settlement, putting that permanence at its most benign. But as white settlers and particularly pastoralists had moved into Aboriginal country, the same pattern had repeated. There was a contest for land and particularly for water. There was a view universally held pretty much by white people that it was incompatible for Aboriginal people to remain on their lands once white people had arrived and wanted to settle it and farm it. That inevitably led to tension and violence in uncounted and uncountable cases, massacres of all sorts, in many cases they included these sort of mounted hunting expeditions that were designed to basically clear the area in question out. And as the and there was sort of an element of what was called teaching the Aboriginal people a lesson, which was all about sort of keeping them quiescent, and at least that was sort of the theory. The reality was that they were seen largely as a nuisance, and one that was best dealt with by removal. In one form or another, either they'd remove themselves or they'd be removed.
It's such an awful part of our history, but something that is still felt by many people today on both sides, on all sides, I would say, from descendants from Aboriginal Australia and also those who are not non-Indigenous peoples who live in this country. But a lot of people in the mainstream system through school don't necessarily learn about this part of Australian history. Have you found with writing your book, Coniston, that there's been any resistance?
No, I haven't struck any of that so far, probably because the book isn't well known enough yet. But also because Coniston is one story which is has been pretty much universally accepted, even in Keith Windschuttle's writings, in which he denies quite a large part of the sort of this dark side of our history, along that sort of theory of the black armband history. Even he acknowledged that Coniston was a massacre. Unsurprising, because the record of it is undeniable, the historical record. Nobody's really sort of, as far as I know, saying it didn't happen or it wasn't a bad thing, which makes it all the more remarkable that it's not actually taught at all.
Last year marked the 90th anniversary of the Coniston Massacre, and on the ABC program Away, ABC's Oliver Gordon spoke to Serafina Presley Napangadi, who shared her family and community's experiences.
I'm Serafina Presley Napangadi. I'm the Kurrungal, I'm the custodian from this area. It's my grandfather's country. I heard my mom tell me a story about herself when she was 10 or 12 years old. And she and her other cousin heard the horses coming and they ran along the riverbed and covered themselves with leaves. And the horses ran past. They heard it.
And that was just in this area?
Yes, it was in this area, along this riverbed.
And they survived the shootings?
Yeah, they survived. Yeah. And I only lost my mum 4 years ago. So she was part of this land here.
Yeah.
Yorkuru. She's from this area.
Yeah.
She grew up around here as well.
Yeah.
She covered herself with dried leaves. And then she lived.
On ABC Radio, Oliver Gordon speaking to Serafina Presley-Napangaridi on ABC Radio. Michael Bradley joins you. He's an author of the book Coniston. Michael, you touched on the court cases that happened after the massacre. Can you tell us more about these and how they played out?
So the background to that, probably important to note that while the killings were happening, the massacres, there were a number of further incidents involving Aboriginal attacks on white people. So there was a fair bit going on in the area at the time. So not long after Fred Brooks was murdered, there was an attack on another white man called Nugget Morton. He survived that attack, although it was certainly an attempted murder. But the attack on him was probably pretty well justified. And he then joined in on the second hunt and was certainly an active participant in the massacres. There were a couple of other attacks on two other white men at the time, one of which was also fatal. And that one resulted in a murder trial as well. As I mentioned, Murray had apprehended two Aboriginal men whose names were Paddy Gar and Akirkra. And they'd been just unlucky victims, essentially. He'd been picked up and, for whatever reason, not shot, but detained by Murray and taken back in chains to Alice Springs and then arraigned on murder charges and in October, I think it was, 1928, they were sent up to Darwin, taken up to Darwin by Murray and put on trial for murder in the Supreme Court up there. And that trial turned into a complete debacle. The Crown, the star Crown witness, was a 10-year-old boy who Murray had also kidnapped and coerced into claiming that he'd been present when Brooks was killed and that he'd witnessed it. That was completely untrue. His evidence on the witness stand was predictably nonsensical, and Murray copped an absolute pasting from the judge, who, as it happened, was an extremely fair judge, in a total sensation with the all-white jury acquitted both men of Brooks's murder and they were released. That triggered an absolute firestorm in the media, and the official response in Canberra internally within the government was consternation and a lot of finger-pointing back in Alice Springs as to how on earth this had happened and what had gone wrong. Certainly, Murray's reputation never recovered from that. So then a few months later, there was a second murder trial an Aboriginal man who'd shot and killed a white guy called Harry Henty. As it happened, that was completely unconnected to the Coniston events, although it happened in the same area around the same time. That seems to be more a result of some personal feud, Murray was involved because he had caught the killer, I call Willoughby Jack, after about a 2 or 3 month epic hunt that actually didn't involve murdering anyone. So Jack, Willoughby Jack was put on trial and also sensationally acquitted on the basis of self-defence, which was, as it turned out, actually what had happened. But it was a surprising outcome because the general result of black on white violence in the territory in those days was not an acquittal. So they're two sort of quite quirky and fascinating bits of legal history in themselves that were sort of, side stories of the Coniston story.
Mm. And I mean, it's still something that is so significant and important today, not just for people living in Central Australia, but for the country at large. I did say that it was last year that it was the 90th anniversary, but I keep forgetting we're in 2020. It was 2018 that marked the 90th anniversary. Yep. It's a new year, Michael. But the Northern Territory Police Commissioner in 2018 did apologise for the actions of officers who were involved in the massacre of the Aboriginal people. This is pretty significant. 90 years on, you have the NT police apologising for what their counterparts 90 years earlier had done.
Yeah, and certainly warranted and appropriate that they did so, although technically it's the federal government that should be apologising. At the time in 1928, what is now the Northern Territory,
of course,
was actually two separate territories.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been split up for no obvious reason a few years before that into Northern Australia and Central Australia, and they were separately administered from Canberra as territories. All of the relevant events happened in Central Australia, which was under direct Commonwealth jurisdiction run by the what was then the Department of Home Affairs, ironically, in Canberra. So Murray and the other police were federal officers. So the direct responsibility was that of the Commonwealth government, and that remains.
Yeah, you're right. The NT wasn't even a considered a thing at that point. Also, a lot of people have been pushing for there to be recognition in some way. Central Land Council Delegate Harry Nelson had asked if a national park could be created around the massacre sites to mark the area's history. Some people have also suggested a national day of commemoration, such as what we do for other events, including Anzac Day. All sorts of things are being thrown around. Larry, hello.
Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
I'm doing well. Larry, you're from Rockhampton, but you actually went to a very important police station.
Yes. At the time, it was around about 1989, I was living in a farm up in Ravenshoe, up on the Afton Tablelands. And me and the local police got on very well, and one day I went into the station and the two lads there were having a bit of a lash at me and said, "Oh, look, you want to go out and shoot a few Aboriginals?" And,
oh, my gosh.
And I was a bit horrified, and I said, "What the hell are you guys talking about?" He said, "Look," he said, "we've been cleaning up the station." He said, "Guess what we found?" And I said, "No, show me." It was licenses to shoot wild Aboriginals that they could issue over the counter.
Mm. And it's a significant site, this police station, because there is this document that, I guess, I don't know if it was an uncommon one or a common one, I'm not sure.
Mm. But this I actually saw the document. It was like a pad where they fill out a license and stamp it and that, and just tear it off and give it to you. And I was totally horrified, because I knew a lot of the Aboriginal people in the area, and they were terrific people. And they were sort of laughing at the fact that it could actually exist. I mean, they were just as amazed.
It makes you feel sick to the stomach, doesn't it?
It definitely does. I spent a lot of time... I used to fly for coastal surveillance up around Cape York, right up to Bamiga, around to Weipa. And I spent 3 years doing that, and I got to know a lot of the Aboriginal people. And to be quite honest, they're beautiful people. They really are. I spent a lot of time at Cape Flattery sand mines, and I think my shield is still in their community hall. They actually made a shield because they knew us so well, because we would land there and if there was any sort of incidents. But I can honestly say every person I knew up there, even in the Torres Straits, when I flew the Torres Straits, were beautiful people.
And, you know, another reason why it's so important for us to acknowledge and know this part of our history, you know, on the text we had, thank goodness this is being written about and it must be taught in school. I also know that Teresa Ross, who ABC's Oliver Gordon spoke to in Central Australia a couple of years ago, is also, you know, has a... also wants to write about it as well. There is great interest in telling this story and people hearing this story as well. Michael, you must have had moments as well where you were feeling quite confronted with this part of Australian history. I do have a text that's come through. I'd be interested in your response, saying this sounds very loudly like revisionist history. Would you call it revisionist history at all, Michael?
No. Certainly not. My approach to this story was to let it tell itself, and I didn't come at it with an outcome in mind because I didn't know what the story was. This story is extremely well documented. What happened isn't really particularly open to doubt, and I'd certainly invite anyone who suspects that that there's revisionism going on here to have a look at the book before they form that conclusion. There was a lot about the story that I found really confronting and often upsetting because it's a story that illustrates a particularly disconcerting aspect of our history, which was the prevailing attitude of white Australia towards black Australia. And one of the things that really struck me about it from reading the archival material, so the internal government documents and memoranda and discussions about what was going on as it was happening, and also the newspapers of the time, letters to the editors, editorials, articles, and other sources such as people's diaries and letters to each other from the time. What really struck me was that the discussion about Aboriginal people and the so-called Aboriginal problem wasn't terribly different from what it is today. What was different was the language. It was certainly a lot more brutal and overtly racist than it is these days. And in many cases, the proposed solutions to the problem, which were much more extreme than is usually talked about these days. The nub of the conversation and the sort of the debate hasn't really moved on. And to me, I think in the end that was the most confronting thing of all, that how little we have progressed on this question.
Author Michael Bradley, author of the book Coniston, Thank you very much for taking some time out and sharing this story. It's a part of our shared history. It's in a very significant part of what's happened in Australia, the Coniston Massacre. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.